My name's Colin Miller, and we're going to talk in the next hour over about the Internet of Things and Microsoft. As I said in the description, I doubt if anybody has not heard about the Internet of Things. I have a Google agent that keeps me abreast of articles and things like that, and with CES just happening, it basically lit up my inbox with all the new projects that are coming out that are somehow related to the Internet of Things. And the analysts are talking back and forth about whether or not it's a hype, it's whether or not it's real, whether or not it's now or it's later. And we'll talk a little bit about that. How many people would say that they're working on a project that's somehow related to the Internet of Things? A couple of people over here. Actually, fair number. Okay. So, well, today what we're going to do is, while there's been a lot of talk about the Internet of Things, there hasn't been much talk about what Microsoft's part of the Internet of Things is, what technology that Microsoft has that's relevant in this space. And so we'll talk very little bit about what the Internet of Things is, in case somebody has been spending the last several years in a Tibetan monastery. And then we'll take a sort of a survey view of what technology Microsoft has that's relevant to this, and then we're going to dive down a little deeper into small devices, and for a couple reasons. One is that that's what I own, is the smallest devices. It's also an area that Microsoft's not particularly well known in, so it's probably an area that may be less familiar with than some of the other things. And also, frankly, one of the reasons why I work in this area, it's more fun than almost anything else. So looking at what the Internet of Things is, a very broad definition of this could be that it's solutions that are either enabled or enhanced by devices that are connected over the Internet. Now, I take Internet as a very, it's not capitalized, because it's a very broad definition of that. I was reading this morning about a project that that's the city of San Francisco is looking at, where they're going to connect up their streetlights and create an adaptive lighting system. And then once they have that in place, they're looking at other things they can use that for, basically a backbone for all sorts of communication, so that they could send, for instance, traffic camera data through that. They can collect energy management metering information through that. So that's an example where it's not technically on the Internet. The Internet may have a part of that, maybe on the back end. So taking connected devices as a large category, I'm sort of lumping those into the Internet of Things. Several years ago now, The Economist had a series of 8 articles on the Internet of Things where they asserted that it is real and it's answering a real opportunity, economic opportunity. GE just came out with a supportive study of that, where they've put a number on this, a value, which is that they see trillions of dollars of economic growth being generated by the opportunities around connected devices. And those are driven by the efficiencies that you can bring to these different things. So talking to utilities companies, for instance, as we did some years back, they didn't know how they were going to continue to grow the generation as fast as demand was growing. So when you look at things like energy, being able to use the energy more efficiently is going to be a requirement as we go forward. If you look at things like maintenance, there's people that wander around a shop just testing things all the time, waiting for things to break and then sending somebody out to fix it. With these sorts of applications, you can do things like preventive maintenance, lowering your costs, lowering your downtime. So those are the kind of efficiencies that these things can drive. And there's also entirely new business models that that these connected devices can generate. So, for instance, you can imagine a real-time pricing. So you have a vending machine where the pricing goes down as the things inside of it start to age. There's the fungibility of data itself. You can imagine a cellular company selling the instantaneous location of cell phones to a company that's generating real-time traffic data, which is actually happening. And or you can change your business model from selling hardware to people to actually just putting it out for people to use and charging in real time per use. So those are the sorts of things that this opportunity generates. So, of course, the idea of a connected device is not new. They've been around for decades. A lot of them have been used in things like industrial automation. So the question is, what's happening now that makes this interesting? If we look back a decade or two at things like the industrial automation, these were very complex applications, and they were largely proprietary. Especially in terms of communication, they either had an industrial proprietary communication protocol or even an in-house one. They were written almost from scratch because there were no existing components out there for them to build on. And as a result, these things frequently cost tens of millions of dollars to put into place. In the embedded space, we're seeing some technology changes, particularly around processors. So 32-bit processors now are low enough cost and energy consumption that they are competitive with what 8 and 16-bit processors used to be. And with that, they bring along the opportunity to run standardized operating systems and stacks that support the communication required for the Internet of Things. We have a growth in communications bandwidth, and this is, and we also have some hungry cell carriers that are looking at the fact that the growth of consumer demand for their bandwidth is peaking out, and they're looking for another opportunity to continue to grow. So they're supporting this as well. We have the common cloud. We have big data analytics. We'll go into these a little bit more. We've already talked about the fact that now we're seeing a greater demand for managing the scarcity of resources. And this is another example from that same GE study where they said that if they can get a 1% savings in the fuel consumption, an industry that is always running on the margin can save, $30 billion over 15 years. And the other thing that's happening is that with the sort of growth in interest, we're starting to get a growth in standardization efforts in Europe, in China, and in the U.S. There are people starting to build components for these solutions. And all of that's going to drive the cost down. So it sort of feeds on itself as it goes back and forth. How many people have seen the Gartner hype curve before? So what this is basically is Gartner noticed that we in technology tend to get really excited about things, only to get a little disappointed later on. And so they created this curve, which shows the first initial introduction of a concept to the peak of inflated expectations down to the trough of despair, and eventually up to some stasis where the technology is actually useful. And one of the things that I've done is circled the things that are either the Internet of Things or related technologies. So you can get an idea of sort of where they think we are on this. We haven't quite reached our peak of unrealistic expectations on the Internet of Things. But on other parts of it, we're actually on the downward curve on that. But all of these are within the next several years. So looking at these applications, even though we have standards coming in and we were starting to get some pieces to build on, these applications are still very complex. They run the entire gamut from the full span of the computer software domain. So you have embedded devices. Either you have them in development for new ones or you're retrofitting old ones that you already have. These often have very diverse tool chains, instruction sets, and processor models. You have a problem of managing these devices. If you're talking about thousands to tens of thousands of devices out there, you're not going to go out and touch each one when it needs a software update. So you need to be able to manage them remotely. You're going to be generating huge amounts of data coming in, so you need the data analytics capability. You need the back-end data resources or cloud resources to support these things. And then you have all the communications complexity with a sort of mix of common communications protocols like HTTP, proprietary ones that have been ingrown either in a particular industry or in the local and in the house, and new ones. I was just reading a couple weeks ago about a new protocol that's going to compete with Zigbee and Z-Wave and Bluetooth called Dash 7. So almost everybody thinks they can do it better than the last person. So So we've kind of talked a little bit about the Internet of Things broadly. So what's Microsoft's part of this? So the interesting thing for Microsoft is that given that the huge span of this problem, Microsoft has a unique position in that we are touching more parts of this than almost anybody else. So if you look at some of the other folks that are busy in this, they might have a good story in analytics. They might have a good story in the cloud. They might be focused on the devices. But Microsoft is looking at almost all those spaces. So let's take a little deeper dive into this. So one of the problems, obviously, with these kinds of applications, if we were to take an application, for instance, like a set of building automation, where you could have thousands of sensors collecting things like temperature, humidity, presence and absence of people, lights in the building that are being used, you have a scale problem that you may not have had before. So if you take an example of a machine to human interaction, like I go out periodically, my wife says too much, to Amazon to buy things. If Amazon's down, they have a back-end problem. I mean, that sucks. And it will generate some press for Amazon and doesn't do much for their business model. But if you built, say, a hospital management system or the environment on a hospital management system on this Internet of Things infrastructure and it goes down, or, for instance, if you have a chain of fast food stores and you're managing the temperature in the coolers, you can actually generate an opportunity to get a lot of people ill, seriously ill. So there's a strong requirement that these things be rock solid, scalable, and reliable. And that's expensive to build. So the question is, does everybody have to build that? Now, I know you had a talk from Scott Guthrie earlier. So Azure is our, cloud infrastructure in general is a response to this. Azure is our response to this. I'm going to focus mostly on the reliability and scalability parts of that. So everything in Azure is designed to fail. So and they do that because they can make the resources fully plentiful. And so instances, there's multiple instances of everything. If a service goes down, it's brought up again. It's monitored by Azure. Looking at, as a specific example on how they handle Azure storage, when you put a file up in Azure, it makes three copies of it. And it's in three different fault domains. So if any of them fails, it monitors that, makes another copy of it. If any of those copies are geographically dispersed, so if there's another Superstorm Sandy that takes out an entire data center, then your services should not be impacted. Looking at it, we talked already about the scale of these devices, about the number of these devices. So you have all these devices out there and you want to communicate with them. You want to send command and control down to them. You want to get data back from them. You might want to be able to talk to an individual device. You might want to be able to talk to the devices of a particular type. You might want to be able to talk to the sensors that are on the sixth floor of the hospital. So how do you address particular parts and communicate with particular parts of your system? And at the same time, you're going to get data back. So how do you manage the data that comes back, which can be in huge volumes, in a way that you can balance it across servers and endpoints so that you can manage your resources? And Microsoft has a solution for that. Service Bus, which is a messaging system that we have in front of Azure. It's targeted at making a scaled out and very secure communications protocol that you can configure yourself to meet your needs. It's used specifically for sending out messages. It's a publication subscribe architecture that employs filters, so you can talk to you can broadcast to everybody, or you can talk to an individual device. This is a diagram that I took from a series of articles by Clemens Vasters that are in MSDN magazine. If you're interested in Service Bus, they're a very good resource. There is one error in this, I think, which is the control flow arrow is pointed in the wrong direction. But what this shows is that the devices across the top talk to these topics. The subscriptions underneath disperse that to the right back-end services. At the same time, you can use that same mechanism, that same model, for talking out to your devices, where you can have you can balance your resources again by using these subscriptions. And what's not shown in there is the ability to insert filters in that communication. So you can filter to the devices on the sixth floor, for instance. There's another advantage to using something like Service Bus. So the initial Service Bus came out, and it was on HTTP, as you would expect. But HTTP is an example of one of those protocols that's available that we can use, but it was never really intended for this kind of application. I mean, it was built up around basically providing, again, machine-to-human interaction. So the model is, it's very heavyweight for the kind of data that's coming back typically. If you're sending back a temperature and a timestamp, then you have 600 bytes of HTTP overhead to send that back. It's not very efficient. And then you get to smaller devices where you're running on a battery, hopefully, it becomes a great deal of overhead. So recognizing this, the Service Bus guys have come out with support for AMQP, which is another protocol. It's been around for a long time. It's been used by the financial industry, and it's used to make very efficient, low overhead messages back. And it's open source. So this is just the point of this is not that this is the be-all and end-all of communications protocols, but rather by using Service Bus, you can let somebody else figure out what the right next set of standards are. And if something else comes up that's better than AMQP, they'll be under some pressure to implement that, rather than you having to chase around those particular protocols. Okay. This is one of my favorite problems. So you have a different type of data. So if we go back to my example of I'm out at Amazon and I'm buying something, I go out relatively infrequently, maybe once a month, compared to the kind of data that you're going to get back from a machine-to-machine interaction. The data that I put in there is very high value. Not only does it include things like my credit card, but I want to make sure that the order's not lost, it's not messed up somehow. Amazon wants to store that, persist that, so that they can make sure that they get the intelligence out of that to offer me more things to buy. The machine-to-machine model is very different in that you have these thousands of devices. Now, they're talking very frequently, maybe every couple seconds, and they're sending data that is, in an atomic level, not very valuable. So I might get back the temperature from a particular sensor on the sixth floor, or that the lights are on in some conference room, but that's not highly valuable, and it's also very transient. So that I'm going to get another reading back in a couple of minutes that's going to completely replace that initial reading. So the question is the old model of taking data, putting it in a database, and then running queries against that, does that work for the machine-to-machine data? And the answer is not quite so well. So what we have is something called Stream Insight. And what Stream Insight does is it allows you to form a query that runs on a stream of data that's never put in a database. It doesn't have to be put in a database. So you can run a query that says something like, let me know when the sensors on the sixth floor, all of them in aggregate, average more than 72 degrees. So you can do transforms on the data. You can run triggers on the data. And this is in place of running that traditional database where the data would go in and then wait for the next time to run the query. So if it's something that you need immediate action on, then this is much, much more applicable because it's going to run queries on the data as it's acquired. These are some of the sample scenarios that the Stream Insight folks have identified. And they're not, frankly, all Internet of Things applications. If you look at the clickstream analysis, There's an example where I want instant action because I want to know at the moment somebody clicks on something what ad I should be looking up to present to them. Not a classical Internet of Things application, but it shows the breadth of this of the usefulness of this technology. The others are a little more applicable. Here's a look at Stream Insight from 10,000 feet. The points here are that the tools are the same. You're going to use Visual Studio, Link Queries, .NET. You can take data from a number of different sources, an arbitrary set of sources. What you do is you write that set of pink source input drivers. So that's where you could do transforms, running averages, whatever you want to do. That data then comes through the system where the queries are being processed on it. And then, depending on what triggers you define, you can have that data go out to pagers, to event. You can put the data in the database if it's meaningful for you at that point. You can run update displays and a variety of other things. Okay, so the last question, last problem we're going to talk about is we talked about the fact that this problem space spans the entire range of devices, a range of computer science, from web to PC applications back end. And one of the interesting things is that most of those areas over the last number of years, we've seen sort of a convergence in terms of the tools that are used and languages that are used. So somebody who works on web pages is not looking at things that are that much different than somebody's working on a PC application. The embedded space has always been something different, though. It's always been sort of an outlier. And that's because of the very strict constraints on those kind of applications. So the embedded space typically uses a different set of developers with different skills and using different languages. And now, especially with the as I mentioned earlier, the availability of 32-bit processors, we can see the convergence of now the embedded space back into the same model. So with .NET, we can have a single programming model and toolchain that now covers the entire space of the Internet of Things solution. This is the set of embedded platforms that Microsoft has, from Windows Standard running full .NET, Compact running Compact Framework, and the .NET Micro Framework at the bottom running very small devices. If you look at across the bottom there, you can see the kind of devices. Windows Standard might be used in a cache register. Windows Compact might be used in the kind of handheld device you'll see in like Lowe's or someplace like that. And the Micro Framework is used on very small devices. And that's where I'm going to focus again, because that's where I think, that's where I work. So the Micro Framework is a re-implementation of the desktop CLR for these small devices. It's very small footprint devices. We're talking about processors in the $2 to $10 range, in the memory in the tens of Ks. It's an entirely rewritten set of source code. As you saw in the other slide, unlike the other .NET, it doesn't sit on top of an operating system, but actually runs directly on the hardware. And we've done that by integrating the execution engine into the CLR. We've added things like we've extended the .NET object model to include things like the typical buses that you find on an embedded device like I2C and SPI. And we've added things that are more interesting to the embedded space, like the power management of the processor is exposed in the object model, as well as battery management and things like that. It's all open source. It's under Apache 2 license. If you're not familiar with the licensing and open source, that is a non-viral license. That means that you don't have to give back whatever you build on it. It's fully integrated with Visual Studio. You can deploy from Visual Studio. You write your code in Visual Studio using C# or Visual Basic. You can deploy from inside Visual Studio, either to an emulator or directly to the device. And then you can debug that code that's running on the device inside Visual Studio using the same tools you're familiar with. We have a porting kit available for moving it around from processor to processor. And the list on the right is a number of the applications that it's already been used on to give you some idea of what kind of applications it's had. This is the stack. And I mentioned that it's directly on the hardware. It is possible. You can see over there's a host OS over on the other side. That's optional. It has been ported to several embedded real-time operating systems. But you can see there's a rich set of managed libraries and application services available that makes a .NET developer very comfortable in this environment. Also very productive. Here's some example applications. This is a hotel in Hamburg. Where they wanted to go green. One of the things they wanted to do was to put controllers in each room. And so you can do things like you can get your internet set up, you can set the temperature. One of the reasons I use this slide is that these three screens across the bottom are actually screens from those devices. And you can see that we have, with inside the Micro framework, we have a subset of Windows Presentation Foundation, so you can create very nice displays very easily. This was an example of a set of developers who had created a very rich school management system in the Netherlands, where you could manage grades and assignments and attendance and everything else, expose that through a variety of websites and phone applications, as well as on the teacher's desktop. And they wanted to put an additional device on the door so that kids could take an RFID badge and swipe that on the way in, and that would take attendance for them. They had no experience on embedded devices. They went ahead and coded that up and added that to their system, even with just using their .NET skills. For the managed code developers, hopefully you get the pun here. The garbage collection in Venice is very expensive. And it's expensive enough that there's apparently a fair amount of fraud, so that people go and put their garbage in somebody else's can. So what they did here, this is a pilot program, they created these new cans that had locks on the top. And you got an RFID badge, and this is running, that lock system runs in Micro framework. And you flash your RFID badge, it opens the can for you, and when you insert your stuff, it actually weighs the garbage. And then when the truck or the boat or whatever it is that they collect the garbage with comes by, it not only collects the garbage, but it collects the data. So these cans don't even have to be connected. They connect intermittently to the collector, which then, sort of through Sneakernet, takes it back to the garbage central, I guess, and dumps the garbage and the data at the same time. And lastly, so we have a company in Finland that did a vending machine remote management system. And you can imagine in Finland you don't really want to be sending out trucks in the Finnish winter unless you absolutely have to. And so this allowed them not only to roll trucks, only unnecessary, but it also allowed them to do some of the things we talked about earlier, things like changing prices. They haven't done it yet, but they've been talking about things like putting down targeted advertising. And they certainly can detect things like any power outages, so they know, for instance, if it's frozen goods, that they have to respond to that immediately, or if there's vandalism, they can respond to that. The Micro framework supports remote management. You can update the firmware, you can update assemblies, you can do almost anything remotely. It has all the cryptography and communications to support that. So we've solved the I'm asserting, anyway, that we've solved the software development on the embedded devices, which leaves us with the hardware problem. Well, how do we manage the electronics? And this one's kind of fun. So this is .NET Gadgeteer, which is plug-and-play electronics. And this is actually probably not a commercial application. It's used for rapid prototyping and for hobbyists. And it's actually what I'll be using today to show off this stuff. It was actually put together in MSR. MSR, Microsoft Research, as you can imagine, creates a lot of devices of their own. Every time somebody comes up with an idea, they want to try out, somebody's got to build a device. The life cycle of that used to be that they would build the device and then define the device, give it to somebody in the hardware lab, And about 2 weeks later, they would get something back that almost got them what they wanted, but could not what they really needed, and so they'd send it back. And they go back and forth like that. So they put together this, and now they can put together these devices themselves, among other things, and also in only a couple of hours. And this is also an open source product that's available. As you can see, the way it works is that there's a main board. It has a processor on it and a number of connectors. And you buy these modules, and the modules all have, again, the same connector. And you can just put them in, plug them into the different sockets on there. And that's all the electronics you need to know. You can throw together, these are all modeled in CAD systems, so you can throw together a case for it really quickly. And these, as I mentioned, are all available commercially. So you can get them at places like Amazon and Mouser, SparkFun. And the cool thing is that this idea caught on, and there's actually a competitive or a complementary technology that's just come out called GoBus from Netduino.com. And these are small. Netduinos are like a $35 .NET version of the Arduino, if you're familiar with that. The GoBus is an extension to that. They've done gone a little bit more upscale. So with a Gadgeteer, you need to know where you can plug the particular devices modules into. With GoBus, they've abstracted that out, so you can actually plug them in anywhere you want. And with that, I think we get to demos. Okay, so. Okay, so this doesn't show that well. Let me slide that guy over. So for the demo, and hopefully the demo gods are with us. One of the things you want to do when you do demos is make sure there's as few moving parts as possible, because everything that will fail. My demos are all moving parts, so bear with me. These worked twice yesterday, so. So the scenario here is we're going to go back to the situation where I'm running a whole chain of fast food restaurants, all of which have a salad bar, and one of the things I want to do is I want to know that the temperatures in the salad bar are maintaining the right range, that I'm not creating a petri dish and I'm not going to end up in a lawsuit and a bunch of people in the hospital. So what I've done here, and it's going to come back here. They told me it would if I tapped it. Ah, there we go. Here what you have is I built a little temperature gauge, quickly enough. And although it's a little hard to read, there's a little display here that says it's currently 72.72 in the room. And it's giving us an alert, because that's obviously too high for our cooler. And so I have two problems with this. One is that it's not very good for a demo, because I can't change the temperature in the room very fast. And the other is that this is now a great device as long as I walk up to every single cooler and look at it. So what we're going to add some... Did I go back? I didn't go back. We're going to add some things to this. What we're going to add is... Oops. We're going to add a potentiometer that I'm going to use for for being able to do the demo, setting the temperature. And we're going to add an XB radio. So the XB radio is an 802.15.4 radio, which is the protocol underneath Zigbee. It can run Zigbee. We're not actually going to do that. But it's going to be able to talk to another Zigbee radio. And now watch closely, because I'm going to do some very complicated electronics here. I'm going to connect that up to that. And then I'll connect that up to that. And then I have those two modules right here. And so that goes into 10. That's a potentiometer. And this is the radio. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Let me go back and show you what I've done here. So this is the potentiometer, and this is the radio, and I've just plugged them into those same slots that we saw in the other display. Okay. And then what I've, which some code changes that I've already made, to be honest with you, so you don't have to watch me type, which is a painful process, is I've, this needs to update. There we go. So here what I've done is I've added the Zigbee radio as a serial port. So basically I just configure it and open the port. And then down a little lower, what I've done is I've taken my potentiometer, and I'm going to turn it down here all the way. And since it's returning a percentage, it's going to be a value between 0 and 1. So I've arbitrarily said that we're going to trigger this if it's greater than 0.45. I'm going to set a breakpoint there. I'm going to go ahead and deploy this to the device. And the deployment's starting. It rebuilds it. It opens up communication channel through USB with the device. It sends the bits down there. It now reboots the device. And it should be all functional at this point. So at this point, it's testing. If we were to look at that code again, I didn't go through what was originally in the application. But what we had was we'd set up a event handler for when we got a measurement from the humidity sensor, and then we'd set up a timer to trigger every 10 seconds, and when it triggers, it then requests that measurement, and it's inside that trigger that I'm now taking a measurement from the potentiometer. So it's been going for a while, and we can actually turn up the potentiometer here a little bit. Now the timing depends on where we are in that 10-second cycle. There we go. So we have hit our breakpoint. We can go ahead and execute. And so what's happened, it's not very visible, is that this device has created an ad hoc network with this device over here, which is connected up with this printer. Ah, yes. Thank you. Okay, so it's connected up with this printer, and as you can see, it sent us the alert that we were looking for, that the temperature is too high. So that's how easy it is to create at least a prototype of an Internet of Things application. Okay, so I have one other demo. That's an example of two devices talking to each other. Let's go ahead and talk to the cloud. And somewhere I have here excuse me. This is an Azure Storage Explorer, so this is looking at an Azure table, and it's got a bunch of data in it, which I will delete for now and requery. And so this scenario, we're in a doctor's office. Somebody comes in complaining of chest pains or whatever, and we want to find out what's going on with them. Can I borrow you for a sec? Come on up here. We'll find out if your heart's still beating, okay? I need a finger. So your finger goes in there. So what it's doing now is it's set up so that it detects when the device is put on the finger. And then once it's taken off, go ahead and take that off, it'll upload that data. So what I didn't do is I didn't requery here. So, but these are the new data. This is the new data that just came in. I apologize. The data doesn't look very good, to be honest with you. This thing is not very reliable after being abused as much as it has. I think your oxygen saturation is probably higher than 45. But hopefully. Yeah. Okay, so that is that's my dog and pony show. The intent is to show you that there is a lot of cool things going on in this space in general. Microsoft has a lot of interesting technology in this space, and that and any .NET developer at this point can develop almost the entire range of this kind of solution, from the smallest devices up to the cloud devices. This device, for this example, I didn't go into it in a great deal of detail, is actually running web services. So that device is talking over DPWS, device profiles for web services. So if you're familiar with web services, you can use those. If you're more familiar with like a RESTful interface, that's easy to do as well. So it has a full range of devices, of interfaces that you might have. So with that, I think I can answer questions if anybody has any.
No. I do. I've played .NET Micro a lot as a hobbyist. But one of my questions is, I noticed that currently IP6 is still tentative for the next version. Has that changed at all?
Yeah, so one of the things we did, initially Micro Framework had, we had a proprietary stack. And two problems with that. One is that they were charging us and we weren't charging, so it wasn't a business model that was very viable. The other thing was, as an open source product, people wanted to be able to get in the stack as well. So we went and got an open source stack from the folks in Sweden, and we're dependent on them. So there is some movement in, sorry, I meant to repeat the questions, when we're going to support IPv6. And they are talking about it. They've been talking about it for a while, and hopefully it's soon that they'll support IPv6. Is everybody familiar with what IPv6 is, generally? Okay. Any other questions? Yeah.
What about zero clients?
What about which?
Zero clients.
I'm not familiar with zero client. What is that?
It's a new trend in computing.
Pardon?
It's a new trend in computing, zero clients, PCs which are dumb.
Oh, okay, yeah. 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 So one of the things we actually do work with a lot of those kinds of devices in Windows Embedded. Some of the challenges we run into is a typical device has a lot of serial interfaces, but not a lot of the lower level interfaces like for IPv6 or like I2C and things like that. But it's the economics. If your application can actually sustain a $300 to $500 device, then a PC level device is a great thing to have. Here we're talking about very small devices. These typically run on a microcontroller, which means that it's a processor that includes all the memory you're going to need. So it doesn't even need an external memory bus, and that's how it gets down to the very low range. So, but .NET, I mean, we focused on the micro framework, but the .NET skills go up through the entire stack. So if you can run any .NET version on these devices, then you're golden. There was another question here.
What about Visual Studio 2012?
Visual Studio 2012. Yeah, you noticed I wasn't running it. So that's not my fault. So the stack, because we're an open source product, we put out a version. It's a collaborative open source. So one of the things that happened when we first went open source is that one of the analysts came. I won't even name her. One of the analysts instantly said, "That's a dead product. Microsoft just killed it." And I contacted her and said, "No, Microsoft didn't kill it. We realized that it's a better model for it." And so she changed her blog to say, "Microsoft says they didn't kill it, but they did." So then when we did the two releases after that, I called her back and said, "You know, see, it's not dead." She said, "Thanks very much for letting me know," and didn't say a thing publicly. So we weren't news for not dying, I guess. But back to your question specifically, we come out with a version in collaboration with the community. 4.2, for instance, was about 50% Microsoft and about 50% contributed externally. Once we do that, then for a lot of what you see available, we have to wait for our partners to actually catch up. So Micro Framework 4.3 has been out for months now. It runs on Visual 2012. But the products that I'm using to demonstrate this, which come from folks like GHI and Netduino, have not gotten quite up to that yet, so I'm stuck. We do have backward compatibility in Visual Studio, so you can actually run a 4.2 product on it, but it's just their stuff hasn't been tested against it, so I had enough moving parts. So, anybody else? No?
Yes,
goodbye. Oh, okay.
You didn't say anything about security in a world of Stuxnet, Flame, and whatnot. Is there any thoughts about how you prevent nasty people from either getting access to your data or, you know, turning all your air conditioners on or off, for example?
Yeah, security is a really tough problem. We have, in the micro framework, we have a lot of the pieces that would be required to start to address that. One of the really hard problems about it is that these devices are out in the wild, right? And once you put a device, once you allow physical access to a device, it's almost impossible to secure it. So we've actually been working with folks like Renesas on some hardware solutions where you can put the keys, for instance, in a hardened chip that you can't tamper with, because if you put your keys anywhere in memory, which is all these things pretty much have, they don't have external storage, then it's going to be available to somebody who can physically touch the machine. So that's absolutely a huge problem in general for the Internet of Things, and it's one that these standards bodies are looking at very closely. My response to that is that, you know, we're looking at making sure that we have the pieces to support whatever the right solution is, and we have people in our security group looking at what, you know, trying to contribute to that. But I'm guessing that that's going to be one of the areas where there's going to be a lot of work in standardization and best practices that hasn't been done yet. So at this point, the state of the art right now is it the things that are being rolled out are things that are not don't have to be that secure yet, or people are doing a lot of work individually to do their own security solutions. So you can imagine something like the risk of somebody tampering with my refrigerator data in my fast food restaurants is relatively low, and so I might take that. Is that it? Okay, thank you.